You'll see that the summary you've got tonight has a number of ticks on it. We've covered those subjects in inverted commas, so doing quite well on time. But we also looked briefly at common sense statements about suffering, a very cheeky thing to say. You're going to have to decide whether is it self-evident or not self-evident. I'll just remind you about those causes of suffering. The first was that the worst suffering is not physical. Now, you mightn't agree with that. And you might tell me your story and I might agree that you've got a good case. I haven't suffered physically very much in my life. But I have seen a lot of patients, and what I have noticed is that the anxiety that some people have as they face some illness is far worse than what they undergo, particularly when it comes to surgery. Relatives of patients sometimes appear to suffer a lot more than the patient, particularly if it's very major, and no more than in the case of a child with a serious illness. I think I mentioned that. The second point was that the majority of suffering is man-made. And that's I borrowed from C.S. Lewis there. He pointed out that so many of the things that we think are terrible in the world, human beings have produced. Man's inhumanity to man is a big part of the problem. We looked at the food problems of the world. And Gandhi reminded us, as many others have, that we have enough food in the world for its need, but not for its greed. So once again, it's a man-made problem, you see, human-caused. We looked at the global crisis. You may have been affected in your super, maybe. And many in the world were shaken by that. It was their first experience, certainly the younger ones, of a major change in confidence. Very strange, isn't it? The markets of the world and the value of your money rests on that strange phenomenon called confidence. Isn't it interesting? And it was shaken, and I commented that perhaps it was just as well. In the wisdom of God, you could not rely on this world's treasure. And Jesus said something about that. But it was, again, greed in high places that was to blame, say the economists, for much of what happened on the stock exchange and regulatory mistakes by banks, we could say. And so I think they're all relatively self-evident. And then I just made the point to finally that the course of the scriptures tell us that the creation began well and will finish well. We are given that assurance. And in the middle is the rough patch, and suffering is a part of that. So I put that as perhaps a self-evident thing. But we go on to the next point, where the subject is avoidable suffering, where it's not perhaps so self-evident that this suffering is man-made. But the point is this, the instruction that God gave to his people, and as we've been grafted into the tree, the way Paul talks about it, horticulturally, to us, is an instruction which is for our good. And I'm going to spend some time tonight talking about health as well. But he only gives us instructions for our good. That's a statement of faith, I guess, for many of us. For instance, he said this to the Israelites via the word of Moses. If you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, and give heed to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases upon you which I put upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. And there's a man who wrote a book based on that. Dr. Macmillan was his name. It was quite a few years ago, so I wouldn't make a great deal of all the medical facts because they may have changed, but the principle he enunciated was simply that one. He wrote, the book was called None of These Diseases, which is, of course, taken from that quote. And what he was really saying is obedience is good for you. It's good for your health. And then he gives many examples, and I'll outline some of them for you, from his book. So in that regard, obedience is good prophylaxis. Now, we were told when we did our medical course, gee, it was 45 years ago, that the aim of modern medicine is prevention. Therefore, to obey the commands is good prevention of illness from one point of view. And he had a lot of examples of this. For instance, leprosy. Leprosy was common. We talked about it when I mentioned Paul Brand. And they didn't understand it fully. But according to the laws of Moses, the leper had to be separated from the community. Contagion could be prevented by quarantine given quarantine rules given by God to Moses. Now, because they weren't given because of sheer health. Health was a new idea. It's occurred more in this last two millennia. So it was usually because he wanted the holiness of his own nature to be reflected in the people. And there were certain disease processes which therefore were not good in the camp. Now, some of these things were very simple things, like personal hygiene. It's worth looking up one or two of these. You may not be aware of it. For instance, Deuteronomy 23. We'll look at a few, if appropriate. You will find them in your notes later on anyway. Deuteronomy 23, verse 14. But I'll start with 12. Yeah, no, 12. You have a place outside the camp and you will go out to it and you shall have a stick with your weapons. What's he talking about? And when you sit down outside, you shall dig a hole with it and turn back and cover up your excrement because the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to save you and to give you up your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy that he may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. What an interesting way to say it. Now, we would say, yeah, that's a very good rule. We do that when we go camping, you might say. Well, here it was 3,000 years ago. It was a rule to do with the God who is holy. Very interesting. We would say common sense. Well, it was a bit more than that. I remember Andrew Chu. Some of you may know him. He's a surgeon who went out to Niger, and the subject is now public health. And he went out as a surgeon. And when we asked him about the things he did there, he said, well, a lot of his surgery couldn't use. He discovered that the most important things he could ever do were simple public health rules. He taught the children to wash their faces and saved many of them going blind from sandy blight. Never mind this, taking out cancers of the bowel. I think he probably took out very few cancers. A, because the people didn't live long enough there to get the cancer. And B, by the time they turned up with cancer, they couldn't be cured. He would fix hernias, but he learned to take out cataracts. He'd never trained to do that because that was a simple operation that enabled people to get on and work. So public health prevention was the point I was making, was so important. And it's always been true that simple public health often comes way before the clever things which we do in our health systems in the Western world. The dead body. If a dead body had been touched, there were periods of quarantine and laws about washing. But of course, this functioned to avoid spread of infectious agents, and that preceded Semmelweis by more than 3,000 years. Do you know Semmelweis? He discovered the cause of puerperal fever. Women who had delivered babies recently, many of them in certain wards caught these terrible bacterial infections and died. He demonstrated that hand washing could save that. What a novel idea. But you see, the Jews knew it 3,000 years earlier, and they knew it because they'd been told by God to do it, not primarily for health, but because of ritual purity. But in retrospect, we would say, how sensible. Unclean animals were named, and it included swine, carrion birds, and shellfish, all of which much later have been shown to carry disease. Of course, the law was again about ritual cleanliness, science being a long way away. But it did confirm the prophylactic value of the instruction. To disobey was to invite trouble. If you disobey a command that saves you, well, you're silly, aren't you? But what are you looking for? Circumcision, that was a sign of the covenant with Abraham. So it was a religious law. But there was an observation from the Mayo Clinic, it's a long time ago now, halfway through the last century. They looked at a series of patients and found that 568 consecutive cases of cervical cancer admitted to the Mayo Clinic, not one was in a Jewish woman. But Jews were 7% of all their client base, so that says something. Now, at that time in the general population, cervical cancer constituted 80% of genital cancers in women. So the Jewish law had a good medical consequence for their race. The same was actually true of penile cancer, which is relatively rare. That was virtually unknown in Jews. And rejection of circumcision for cultural rather than medical reasons in our day, because you'll realise that what was once sort of a common cultural performance, it's only actually a small factor in the high incidence of cervical cancer in Western civilization. The rejection of the moral law is a big factor. And now, it having been so rare in certain groups, there have now been a flood of venereal cancers, and it's because of the change in the obedience to moral law. So in a way, it's there for those who will listen and see. And so the self-inflicted disease. So you see, it's avoidable from one point of view. From an important point of view, we could mention lung cancer. And that's one of the commonest. When I was doing medicine, and for the next two decades, lung cancer was the commonest cancer and the commonest cancer to kill people in our community because of smoking. It is reducing right now. Again, in the middle of last century, in 605 cases, again, I think it was the Mayo Clinic, only eight had cancer of the lung who were non-smokers. All the rest were smokers. It was a self-inflicted wound. Before 1912, now that's a long time ago, that's the year the Titanic sank, if I remember rightly, lung cancer was then called the rarest of diseases. Can you imagine that? It's less than a century ago. And during the period in which most of the world smoked, lung cancer became that commonest cause of death, as I just said. It's also been a major factor in the cause of heart disease in that same period. Some years ago, you may remember, there was quite a furore in the newspapers, in the headlines, because a group of cardiac surgeons in the United Kingdom decided to give priority in coronary artery bypass grafting to non-smokers over smokers. What a terrible thing. But they said, no, it helps us. We get much better results in non-smokers. Perhaps it was merely looking after their own interests, get their figures up, you know. But it was seen as a value judgment, which you're not allowed to do. And by the way, doctors are very bad at doing, historically, very bad. But they did it, and I thought that was quite something. Well, we've got other conditions we can mention. Obesity is an obvious example of modern self-limiting disease. self-inflicted disease. It occurs through ignoring what you might call common sense rules of eating and lifestyle. I've said, and my wife gets annoyed when I start talking about it, it's really primary school arithmetic. X equals Y, input equals output. That's how complex the subject is. And yet it's a multi-billion dollar complex industry, if you will believe the advertisements. You need help to do it. You need to be shown how to do it. There's a constant string of diets to help you do it. Well, you don't actually need any of them. But it is a self-inflicted wound from one point of view. I'll go on to something which you do know something about because you can't avoid it. AIDS. Surely this is an example of a self-inflicted disease. AIDS stands for Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. And it's caused by infection with the human immunodeficiency virus. The two are separate. The virus can cause an infection for anything up to 10 years before the AIDS syndrome comes on.
The name was given to it after it had been called GRIDS in the early days.
Called?
GRIDS.
GRIDS.
G-R-I-D-S.
Yes.
Gay-related.
Well, it was called the Gay Plague once. Yeah. I'll read you a bit from a doctor who spends most of his life working amongst these people. His name is Dixon, Patrick Dixon, and this book is kept up pretty well. I think this is only a few years old, this particular version. Can't get the page. Yes. It's in the very early 1980s it first appeared in the world. By 10 years later, he says there were 126,000 cases in the United States, at least 200 to 300,000 feeling unwell and probably infected. In New York, AIDS became the commonest cause of death for men and women aged between 25 and 44. And that was more than 20 years ago. 100 AIDS deaths every week. This is just in one city. And so what was called initially the gay plague has become a pandemic. He says AIDS is not a gay plague. There are millions more women and children infected with HIV throughout the world than there are gay men. It gained this reputation in the United States because gay men were the first to be diagnosed, but now 98% of all new infections worldwide are heterosexually acquired and in the poorest nations. He said in India alone, and then he points out that it is often combined with other venereal diseases and they aid and abet the AIDS condition. He says regarding HIV, in India alone there are more sexually active people alive than adults in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. By 2001, India had more HIV cases than any other nation. In Bombay alone, Mumbai, it's now called. When this was written, there were at least 1,000 new infections on estimate occurred every night. You see, there is something that's hard to really take in about this. I think there's one more comment, and then I'll leave that. Yes, the relationship to STD, sexually transmitted diseases, I mentioned. 50% of all adults in Mumbai, India, are carrying an STD. That's a hard thing to take in. I can't quite take that in. That's what he says. Worldwide, there are an estimated 250 million new STD infections every year. He says 300 years ago, a plague broke out in Europe and spread across the Western world. Vast numbers died. Early symptoms were mild. The second stage made people very ill. And half of those who developed the third stage died, many with brain damage. What was that? Syphilis. But it had a cure. They always go for cures by some technical way. It was an antibiotic. But you can see it doesn't get to the crux of the problem. And that's how it is with AIDS. It would seem as if no government will ever stand up and says, don't behave immorally. They dare not say anything like that. They never do.
Uganda?
They do. And in fact, the Africans are coming up trumps in several areas in these days. It's quite interesting. But I remember, and some of you might remember, a politician who would have been 15 years ago, I think, because you almost have almost no chance of acquiring the HIV virus in an Australian hospital. And a politician said, a person needs to be very careless. He said, you've got to get someone to give it to you. He got into terrible trouble for saying that. But you see, there's an element of real truth in what he was saying. So these categories of suffering you could call self-inflicted wounds. Later on in Deuteronomy, we read from a bit of it, Deutero Secondnomian Law. So second reading of the law is how we think of it, although the Hebrew actually means these are the words. Moses makes clear with great detail what God requires of his people. It's all based on the relationship of love which God has for his rescued people. And having made the content of the Torah clear, he enunciates the blessings of obedience in the city, in the field, and the fruit of their bodies, their ground, their animals, their food supply, you may remember, and the cursings of disobedience. So I'm putting this in the category of avoidable suffering. And that's the reason. I'll just quote you a bit from Deuteronomy 30. If you will return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice and all that I command you this day, with all your heart and with all your soul, then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, cleaving to him, for that means life to you and length of days that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to give them. So that's, if you like, avoidable suffering. And now we move on to another, the direct judgments. You see, they often need explaining. Well, I suppose the scriptures do always explain them. But here is a bit of a Bible study, and we may look up one or two of them, but I will mention them all, firstly from the Old Testament. Genesis 15, I think we'll read that. Genesis 15, 12 to 14. Direct judgments we're talking about. As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. This is the covenant with Abram. And lo, a dread and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, know of a surety that your descendants will be sojourners in a land that's not theirs, and will be slaves there, and they will be oppressed for 400 years, looking ahead to their slavery in Egypt. But I will bring judgment on the nation which they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. So the plagues are foretold as a judgment of God. In Genesis 19, we have the example of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, that is a classical case of judgment, if you want one anywhere in history. And Genesis 19, verse 15, speaks specifically of the punishment. 19:15. Yes. When morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, arise, take your wife, your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. So you see very clearly pointed out in the scriptures when there was this example of a direct judgment. So you're not left in a lot of doubt. Now we'll mention a number of others. Oh, there is another one I think it's worth looking We won't look up all of the examples, but Numbers. Turn to Numbers. Deuteronomy, Joshua, I think. No. Judges. No. I've missed it. Numbers is, it's before Deuteronomy. 12:10 was the example I was thinking of. And, of course, it's the well-known example of Miriam. And verse 1 says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married this particular woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And I love the way the scriptures put it. And the Lord heard it, as if he wouldn't. And then mentions that Moses was a very meek man. And then God speaks to them. And he says, how is it that you're not afraid to say that? I am doing this, and you are thinking it's a matter of self-aggrandizement in some way or another. And you remember, Miriam was then struck with leprosy, and Moses intervened on her behalf. I think you'll find that in those first 10 verses of Numbers. We won't read them all. And she was quarantined outside the camp, which was one of the things that they always did, according to the health rules. So she had offended, and God said she would need to do her time, like those who are unclean. Number 16, and we won't read that, but I'll mention it to you, and you'll know it. It's the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. With 250 other leaders, they grumbled at Moses because of God's authority on him. Same issue, you see. And they wanted to run the worship their way. Ever heard of that in any churches? Run the church their way. I've heard of ministers who are terrified of some organists in some churches. And I won't say too much more about it, because they want to take control of the agenda.
I knew one like that.
We won't say anything more. We've seen it and we've heard of it. And it was a terrible judgment, and it was said to be so. And God warned Moses, who called the people away from the rebel leaders who were standing there. You remember, the ground opened up and swallowed the rebels, their kin and all their belongings, then closed over again. Then the fire from the Lord consumed the 250 leaders who were rebelling along with them and wanting to change the worship. You see, worship was not a matter of how I feel I would like to do it and give me a bit of power. Got nothing to do with it. God gave a very stern lesson to them. 2 Samuel 12:14 is an example which you all know. David's son of his adultery with Bathsheba is to die by the decree of Nathan, or God via Nathan. You are the man. Therefore, this child shall die. And David did everything he could think of to prevent that happening, but the judgment was carried out and the child died, and David accepted it. He understood that that was right. He knew God. He knew God's heart so well 1,000 years before Christ. How could he know the heart of God so well? And that's attested to by the millions who find great solace, great strength from the Psalms, because it is a revelation of the heart of God. 2 Kings 5:27, I love that one. I think we'll read a bit of that. 2 Kings 5, it's very well known. Naaman, it's after the healing of Naaman, the Syrian, from his leprosy. 20-24 tells us, when Naaman had gone, because, of course, Elisha wouldn't accept any gift. He said, no, I don't want any of your gifts. The Lord has done this. You go in peace, because the Syrian had a problem, you see. He believed in the God of Israel, but he had to go into the temple of their false god. He said, well, pardon me, I have to still go in with the king. He said, yes, go in peace. But when Naaman had gone from him a short distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, See, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian in not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi followed Naaman, and when Naaman saw someone running after him, he alighted from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me to say, have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim, two young men of the sons of the prophets. Pray give them a talent of silver and two festal garments." And Naaman said, "Be pleased to accept it." Delighted is what he was saying. And he went on his way. And of course, Gehazi would have had to have at least two men carry these gifts back to his tent. Why? Because a talent of silver weighs 34 kilograms. It was as if he was saying, "My master is a generous man. These very poor people have come. And he wonders if you could leave something that we can give to the poor people." It was a very, very wonderful idea, wasn't it? And you remember Gehazi slipped into the tent. And I see in my mind's eye that Elisha was doing something. He might have been writing. And he didn't look up in my imagination. "Where have you been, Gehazi?" he said. "Oh, nowhere." No, he never goes anywhere. It was such a stupid answer. And Elisha knew. He said, "Did I not see you in the spirit? Was this the time to be receiving gifts? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman will cling to you." And he became leprous instantly. And that was a judgment of God. Immediate and very obvious. And another I could mention is Nebuchadnezzar. You see, he became insane for his pride in his kingly power and glory, becoming like an animal for a period, after which he was restored. He then became a worshipper of the God of Israel, recognizing his justice and his righteousness. In a sense, he was cured by his insanity. And you find that in Daniel 4. And it was a very clear judgment of God. And Daniel was the prophet on that occasion. But there are New Testament examples of these direct judgments, and you're aware of many of them. The best known is probably Ananias and Sapphira in Acts 5. And they emulated Barnabas in his generosity. Barnabas was a very generous man. And they made out they'd done the same, sold a field and brought the whole proceeds and put them at the feet of the apostles. But they connived to lie about the amount. They kept some back for themselves. And this deceit was called lying to the Holy Spirit. Presumably there was a gift of knowledge or something by which Peter knew in the spirit that they were lying. And first Ananias dies and is buried. Sapphira was out, probably out having an interview with the investment banker or something. And she didn't know what had happened. So as she came in, Peter said, "Did you actually sell it for this much?" "Oh, yes," she said. He said, "Those who've just buried your husband are coming in now and they're going to bury you too." So he foretold the judgment of God and she dropped dead, and there was no CPR in those days. And I got a sneaking feeling it wouldn't have worked. And I've often wondered, if people drop dead from telling lies in our churches today, what would the roles look like? Just a question. I have no idea of the answer. Acts 12:22 mentions the death of Herod. I forget which Herod it was. There were about four of them, as you remember. And the people claimed that this was the voice of a god and not a man. And he did not contradict them. He thought, "Yeah, I don't mind that." He accepted the status. And he was stricken immediately as the angel of the Lord smote him, as I think that might be the authorized version. And he was eaten up of worms and died, which is just a wonderful description. And I really don't know what that was. There was a medical opinion that this might be consistent with a hydatid cyst rupture. But this is conjecture, because there's a very rapid death from the immune reaction when that happens. But that's beside the point. The point is, it happened at that moment for that reason. Acts 13 speaks of Elymas the magician. He was suddenly struck blind. Paul, having predicted that and pronounced it, for his seeking to turn the proconsul Sergius Paulus from believing. He wanted to hear the word of God, and Elymas got in the way. Once again, those who oppose the gospel and stand in the way of other people hearing it, what would happen if that judgment was carried out? It seems like it was a very special time. It was a great time of revelation of what was true in that early church. It was a very powerful church. And you can be sure that when these things happened, there was great awe amongst the people. A pity there's not more awe today. But in certain places there is. And it's where the church is growing rapidly, often in third world countries when they're under persecution. The same sort of things do happen. I actually think Paul's own conversion, a judgment occurred there, is not an obvious one. He was confronted with the risen Christ being struck blind and falling to the ground. I see this as a sort of living metaphor. You see, he was a brilliant scholar, as I probably said, a tertiary PhD student, really. And he really understood the law of the Jews very well from one point of view, without understanding what it was for. So he saw nothing of the truth, who was Jesus, because he was persecuting Jesus until that day. And his sight was restored when Ananias prayed for him, and he was filled with the Holy Spirit. And it was a judgment of extraordinary kindness, but God convinced or told Ananias, no, you do as you're told, because this man's a chosen vessel to me. I will show him how much he must suffer for my name as he bears the truth before kings and the sons of Israel. So there was really a judgment, and Paul was grateful for it. He was never the same again. He never recovered from that event. We thank God for it. So these are explicit cases, you see, where it's made clear that God brought the judgment for a special reason, and he made it apparent. The scriptures make it clear. So that doesn't allow us to think whenever some unpleasant thing occurs that it is a direct judgment of God, but I think he sometimes shows his people when it is, even in these days. There's a wonderful reference in Isaiah 26. I first saw the significance of this. I'm sure it was Grant who was telling a group. And I'll quote from verses 8 to 10. In the path of your judgments, O Lord, we wait for you. For when your judgments are in the earth, the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. If favor is shown to the wicked, he does not learn righteousness. In the land of uprightness, he deals perversely and does not see the majesty of the Lord. And you see how that's square in the middle of our subject of suffering, in this case, of judgments. Judgment and justice have the same root word, actually. They have a lot in common. The judgments of God are good. That's what our friend the rabbi couldn't quite see. It was love doing what needed to happen. Now, we can't always see it. We won't always understand. And at the time of our suffering, it is almost a law. We will not understand why God is doing what he does. And a third category of suffering, examples from the scriptures, are suffering as an attack. Jesus told a parable about a man who sowed good seed in his field, and at night, someone came along and planted, the enemy came and planted weeds, and up they came. And the farmer said, an enemy has done this. So suffering as an attack is another specific example of an affliction which comes upon people from the attacks of the enemy. And I don't think we should ever put all illness in that category. Some groups in Christendom do. So it's a variant, really, of the direct judgments that we've just been talking about. but it occurs under the sovereignty of God like everything else. And there, it just reminds us that there is some relationship between sin in the world and many forms of suffering in general. So I'll give you a couple examples of this. Chronicles 21, Satan incites David to number Israel, a rather unusual word, and David wasn't meant to do that, and the head of his forces thought that was wrong. You'll find it if you're looking for it in 1 Chronicles 21:1. And David got into trouble for doing that. Interestingly, the same word is used in Job 2, where the writer of Job puts into the mouth of God, talking to Satan, "You incited me to do this to Job and to strike him down with illness." Interesting. In the New Testament, the devil tempted Jesus in the wilderness, a testing and a difficult time for him. So, if you like, it was a suffering with a physical deprivation, although I imagine that his testing was harder than the fasting. Do you remember who led Jesus into the wilderness? The Holy Spirit. So that's one of the perplexing things, you see. We have trouble with that. The attacks of the devil come with the foreknowledge and permission of God himself. So it all must be within his will. There's no dualism there, if you can see that. There's no God and Satan having a tussle, and if God happens to blink, we get struck. There's a view of illness which is not true to the scriptures, therefore it's not true. Jesus in Luke 13:16 spoke of this woman whom Satan has bound for 18 years. The woman bent over. We would have thought perhaps she had ankylosing spondylitis. Whatever it was, Satan had bound her and Jesus released her. And while he doesn't speak like that about most of those that he healed, there must have been many others similarly released, because he was the stronger man who overcame the strong man who had many people captive. Paul himself, you remember, had the thorn in the flesh, and you'll find the reference in, this is study, I think it's called 4, and you've probably got that already. The thorn in the flesh, and he speaks about it in a strange way, which was given me, the messenger of Satan, to buffet me. But he believed that it was to keep him from being too elated. It was God's gift, but it was given by Satan. Isn't that interesting? I can't explain that fully, but Satan was the agent, you see, doing the will of God. In one sense, he can't do anything unless God allows him. You may remember that Jesus warned Peter that he was going to be sifted as wheat. But he said, Satan desires to have you, as if he had to ask permission to try Peter. Interesting. But it was in God's hand, and Jesus said that most encouraging thing, "And when you have turned," not if, "when you have turned, I prayed for you, when you have turned, strengthen the brethren." What an encouragement that would be. I'll stop at those examples of suffering as an attack, and we'll leave Job till next time, because I just want to tell you a story. I tell these stories because they happened and they're true. I can't always interpret them for you. Last time I left you with a strange event which I didn't know what was going on, but I was sure God was doing something. I was intrigued by watching him work in a person's life. I was moved to think what we call a tragedy and a disaster may not be, not when we see clearly, not with the retrospectoscope from heaven. We'll have to recategorize a lot of things, I feel. This story is about Jill. And Jill is a woman who came to me as a patient early on in my career as a surgeon. She was brought in by her father. She was in the low 40s. Brought in by a father who was a very well-known radiologist of a big radiology group in Adelaide. And she had it good, one would have said. She was qualified. She was a TAFE lecturer. She had was married to a business tycoon. He was probably a millionaire. She had an acre of garden. She had three lovely children. Life was bliss. That's having it all, isn't it? But she was brought into me because she had bled, been seen by a gastroenterologist, colonoscoped, and he found a large rectal tumour and then tumours all the way around the colon, right round to the cecum where the appendix lives. Many of these were biopsied and some were benign, some were on the change, but the large rectal tumour was a cancer, and it was an advanced cancer. The CT scan showed it was advanced in the sense that it was big and was going through the wall. The liver was apparently clear. So I knew she needed an operation. There was only one thing we could do. Total removal of the whole large bowel together with the rectum and anal canal and a permanent ileostomy. The whole colon was turning into a cancer. And she was young. She had no known family risk. So this was a strange thing. In these days, we would do genetic studies. In those days, no such thing was known. The pathology report was bad. It was a mucus-secreting adenocarcinoma. That's bad news. 14 out of 18 lymph glands in the specimen were involved with tumour. And that was bad. But the liver was clear, apparently. So she had the operation. If it hadn't been clear, I probably wouldn't have done that operation. I would have tried to find some way of doing something less. She had chemotherapy, radiotherapy afterwards. That was just beginning to be standard. I got to know her during this time. She was easy to talk to. Her life had changed a lot. Because of what had happened. And it was about 18 months later that her liver functions went up. I was seeing her regularly, and I did a CT scan, and she had multiple liver secondaries. It's all too common when you have that sort of pathology. That's why she had been having the chemo radiotherapy, but it couldn't actually stop what happened. Two things happened. Her husband left. He was a man much too busy to deal with a sick wife, he would have said, and she met Christ. How did that happen? I asked her. I don't know, she said. I've so often seen this now that I'm no longer surprised when people don't know how they became a Christian. And when we were in the Evangelical Union in the university, we knew how people became Christians. It's because people witnessed in a certain way and quoted certain verses. Don't you believe it? It's not the truth. Everything from God helps. And 100 other things that we know nothing about, I believe. Anyway, she'd met Christ. She knew him. And it was wonderful. And I saw a lot of her because I started giving her the chemotherapy. I used to do that in those early days. Increasingly, we had wonderful fellowship. After a while, I stopped sending her accounts because, after all, Medicare didn't cover having good fellowship and praying for people. Neither it should. Any government officer would agree. We exchanged books. We often prayed together. She grew like a mushroom so fast. One day I remember her coming in and she was jaundiced. Jaundiced people never look that well. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that. I said, "How are you?" It's a sort of silly thing to say. And she gave me a smile, which doesn't look good from a jaundiced patient, but she said, "Wonderful. Every day is like a great adventure." Now, how about that? And that's the way it went on for some months until she became quite ill and had to be admitted to a hospice, where I continued to visit her and we continued to swap books. And she was totally at peace. And she had a joy about her, which was not a common thing in patients that I had seen. And after she died, her family brought back her books, or my books, and they said, "We'd never seen her so much at peace and so content in her whole life." It quite moved her family. Very interesting thing, isn't it? I won't ask the question which I've asked before because we've finished, but the question, of course, was would that have happened if she hadn't got cancer? Well, we don't know. Can't answer the question. But what an amazing thing. And she was never sorry for herself. She was only delighted. I remember writing to her father, who, as I say, I knew well, and saying I just felt I should write and say I so admired her and I was so delighted by her attitude. And she obviously had come into something very real. You don't know how those things will affect the rest of the family, but I got a fair idea that they always do. Next time we will look at Job briefly and then go to our next study,